Hi, everyone. Welcome to Weird Era, a literary podcast where we ask the right questions. Today, we are talking to novelist Maria Stovall about their novel, I Love You So Much, It's Killing Us Both. Maria Stovall has written fiction for the anthology Black Punk Now and for Ninth Letter Volume 1, Brooklyn, Hobart, The Manola Review, and Joyland, and nonfiction for the Los Angeles Review of Books. Full stop, Hanif Abdulkarib's 68205, The Paris Review, Poets and Writers, and Lit Hub. I Love You So Much, It's Killing Us Both is her first novel, and 24-Hour Revenge Therapy is her favorite Jawbreaker album. She lives in New Jersey. Set in the suburbs of Los Angeles and New York City, I Love You So Much, It's Killing Us Both is an immersive journey into the life and mind of Khaki Oliver, who's perennially trying to disappear into something, a codependent friendship, an ill-advised boyfriend, the punk scene, or simply the ether. These days, it's a meaningless job and a comfortingly empty apartment. Then, after a decade of estrangement, she receives a letter from her former best friend. Fiona's throwing a party for her newly adopted daughter and wants Khaki to join the celebration. Khaki is equal parts terrified and tempted to reconnect. Their platonic love was confusing, all-consuming, and encouraged their worst impulses. While stalling her RSVP, Khaki starts crafting the perfect mixtape, revisiting memories of formative shows, failed romances, and the ups and downs of desire and denial, while weighing the risks and rewards of saying yes to Fiona again. One song at a time, from 1980s hardcore to 2010's emo, the shared and separate contours of each woman's mind come into focus. Will listening to the same old songs and repeat doom Khaki to a lonely life of arrested development? Or will hindsight help her regain her sense of self and pave a healthy path for the future, with or without Fiona? Hi, Mariah. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I absolutely read the book copy as it was pitched to me, and I was into the book, but I guess it's been a minute since I read back. My first question was literally, what's your favorite Jawbreaker album? It's been answered. I guess since it's been answered, well, maybe you can reiterate to the listeners which one it is and why.
Yeah. So if I'm remembering correctly, which I think I am, 24-Hour Revenge Therapy is the first one that I heard. And I think, like, oftentimes, the first one is like the one you get the most attached to. But I think I also like it because it's the shortest one. I'm like, mm-hmm. very pro albums being like 35 minutes or less. That just like is typically a preference of mine. I obviously can like make exceptions for things. But I don't know. I just think like it's very, I don't know, like it has its like catchy moments and everything, but a lot of the sentiment on it just feels like very palpable to me. But I think it's also like not like overly, not that any of their music is, but I don't think it's like overly pretentious or anything in the way that it's like mixing that sort of like self-reflection and self-awareness with some songs that you can kind of sadly sing along to. So yeah.
Can I ask how the band or the record was introduced to you, first fell into your life, your hands?
That is a good question. I can't remember. There are definitely some bands and albums where like I kind of know exactly what my entry point was, but I think they're just kind of so respected and like so important. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing for like people of my generation is that there is a lot of reverence for their follow-up to this album, mm-hmm. Which is called Dear You, which has the song that the name of the book is taken from on it. And that was like, you know, their big, at the time, viewed as like their sellout record. And like, there's a rumor that I've I'm pretty sure has been like confirmed as not being true, that like when Dear You came out, it's a little bit, less traditionally punk and everything. That like when they would play songs off of it live, the people in the crowd would like turn their backs to the stage and just were like not having it. I don't think that's actually true, but it was definitely controversial when it came out, which it's just funny because like by the time I was starting to listen to them, it's like considered like one of the most important, best of all time. So it's just funny how the narrative changes like from one generation to the next.
Definitely. A Jawbreaker was something that I sort of had to inherit. I think, again, generationally, it wasn't something that I was necessarily raised with. But so I guess if Jawbreaker is of the ether times, maybe relatedly and given the mishap of my question, I can ask you if you have a favorite brand new album, because that was huge for me.
That it's funny that you ask that. I mean,
I know it's a controversial thing. We literally talk about it in the book, but I know it comes
yeah.
with its, but musically.
I mean, I feel like I have to say The Devil and God, but I will say that there was definitely a point in my life where Your Favorite Weapon was probably the most album or the album that I'd heard the most times in my life, because I just started listening to it pretty young and just listened to it all the time. But then I'll also say, like, I feel like I was the only person who liked Daisy, and
I
a
love
lot of people
Daisy.
like hated on that album. But I haven't listened to anything that they put out after that. But I think my boring answer is probably The Devil and God.
I will just say for listeners, I'm realizing not everyone has the background, so the sort of controversy about it now is, so often the case with artists these days is some sort of sexual assault allegations for the lead singer. And if you want to learn more about it, I encourage you to Google, but just to give you some backstory. And again, it is touched upon in the book very briefly. Thank you. Thank you for talking records with me. This book is deeply centered around the theme of eating disorders, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on things like trigger warnings.
I don't personally think that I benefit from them or kind of expect them, or feel like I need them, and maybe I'm wrong about that, but I am very aware of the fact that the book copy does not, mention that by name, and things like that. And I think part of it is just because, as was confirmed when I was trying to get this book published, that's a topic that a lot of people don't want to engage with for various reasons. And I think for some people, as you might be suggesting, it is because it's just too close to home for them. And I think for other people, it's kind of viewed as like frivolous or not important or shallow or something like that. And so that is something that I thought a lot about in terms of how to pitch and market the book. So I, it's not like I'm trying to hide it from anyone, and I don't want to, upset anyone who, I think, the reviews will make it clear that that's a theme, and hopefully help people out who do prefer to have some sort of warning going in. But I think I just didn't want to like pigeonhole the book or flatten it by leading with that. And so, yeah, there's no warnings on the book itself. But I hope that doesn't like traumatize anyone, but that is a chance that I guess I decided to take. I don't know. I think that it would, I don't know, trigger warnings are interesting, right? Because it's like how, where do you draw the line in terms of like when to use them and which ones to use and like where to put them and how to phrase them and things like that. And maybe my not wanting to engage with them is just out of like some sort of intellectual laziness and not wanting to like make up my mind about how to do it. But I don't know. I think that whenever I pick up a book for adults, I kind of know that it might have some, quote unquote, adult or difficult content in it and just kind of take it one page at a time personally.
I agree. And also, isn't there a sort of way that, like, a reader, and I mean, I'm talking about myself as a reader, but I don't think I'm the only one, is like looking for that. You know, if you're entering the book sort of knowing that it's going to delve in pain and or specifically eating disorders, I feel like I want the writer to be precise about the pain of that thing. I feel like the writer wants to be precise about the pain of that thing. I think the pain is intended to be communicated, so I'm not sure that a trigger warning does service to like the skill of the writer, or what a writer is trying to do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's also like every person in general is different, and then like even more specifically, like everyone who has an ED, like that's different person to person as well. So it's like again, what, how do you even like something that is one person would want flagged, another person wouldn't, and so I think that is why it's just like. It's yeah, it's hard in terms of like not only doing a disservice like potentially to the writer, like you said, but also to the reader who you're trying to sort of protect or just like be mindful of.
To me, one of the most poignant and elegant ways eating disorders are described in this book is on page 137 when Khaki says, "I reduced myself like a fraction, reduced myself like a sauce set to simmer. I had a million names for it, none of which was starving." And I think what's so special about this phrasing is the emphasis on reduction, which is much more active and less stark than the word starving. And I think that the general view about EDs, especially, I mean, you can have overeating EDs and all kinds of it, but in the sense of anorexia or anything within that theme, I think people read it and jump to the word starving. And that's what I find so eloquent about this phrasing. Can you talk a bit about the ways in which the eating disorder, at least you explore in this book, is really about a reduction, not a starving?
Yeah, that is something that like I think is kind of an eternal question is like is anorexia is it not eating, which is a negative phrasing or perspective, or is it eating not enough, which is like taking an action, a positive phrasing and way of looking at it. And I don't think that I have the answer, and I think I go back and forth on that a lot. But I think that there's the phrase in the book copy, desire and denial. And I think that whether it is one or the other, whether it is reducing your behaviors or adding behaviors to your life, that it's always just like two sides of the same coin. But there is, I think for some people, the sort of quantification, like reducing something, there's like a that physical aspect to that, and whether it's like on legible in the body itself or within like numbers that someone is fixated on. I think that's just something that to me is like a an interesting feature to explore, though I don't like to say interesting because I think like as soon as you call an eating disorder interesting, it starts to get into like questionable glamorization and certain parts of the internet territory, which I am not in support of, but also I'm not, I sh shouldn't say this, but I'm going to say this. I think that there is potential for there to be some value in spaces online where people can, if nothing else, be honest about their thoughts. I think that kind of egging each other on, is not a net positive. But I think that the idea that you're not the only person going through something is like can be very powerful, but then the other side of that is like normalizing certain things can be dangerous. But yeah, I mean, overall, I'm anti, all the weird internet stuff that seems to be, pro EVs or whatever. But I also, a lot of it, I think if you really look at it, I don't think that I would call most of it pro. I think it's something else, and I don't know exactly what that is. But I think again, it's very easy. I think when people are talking about these things, to just be very dismissive of it. And yeah, I don't know. That's what I'll say.
Were you a LiveJournal girl?
No, I wasn't. Someone else asked me that recently. I was a Tumblr girl for a bit. And I don't think, something that like always eats away at me is that I cannot like to save my life remember if I had a MySpace or not. Like I think I did, but if I did, it was like very short-lived. But I was on Tumblr for a bit and then on some kind of music message boards, but like I wasn't posting really. I was more just like kind of lurking a lot.
I mean, I definitely was, so I'm projecting, but and it was definitely like a lot of the root of like my musical fandom, all that stuff that comes with youth. But I guess I'm asking because you just sort of said that, speaking to these online forums that aren't necessarily saying good or bad things, as you pointed out, you sort of highlighted that at least they're a space to talk about them and that the internet sort of does give that avenue, which is, certainly it comes with its cons for sure, but I can see the pros in terms of people who are afraid to talk about things like this in other settings. And anyway, I know for sure that I personally didn't deal with it myself, but I had access to a lot of mental health education just because you create this online community of people that are willing to talk about things that they're probably not going to their actual elders with. Another really complicated thing about the book that the book explores is the ways in which self-destruction can be interpreted as selfish. So Khaki is really angry at Fiona for not seeing her worth because it constantly threatens a loss for Khaki herself. In blatant terms, I feel like we ha live in a culture that where we're not permitted to be angry at our mentally ill loved ones, which is crazy, they're ill. But at this, I mean, it makes sense they're ill, but at the same time, why wouldn't we be angry at this constant threat of loss? If they're a loved one, then hearing them express this desire is obviously going to trigger something in us, and I can understand why that would come out as anger. So I guess my question to you is, why shouldn't we be angry at this constant threat of loss, especially if we love them so much?
Something that I think about a lot, and try to just read different people's perspectives on is the line, if it exists, or the point, if it exists, at which, if someone kind of wants to go, you just gotta let them go. And not just in terms of a relationship, but in terms of being alive. And my favorite eating disorder novel that I don't think I can ever read again because it like really destroyed me is The Vegetarian by Han Kang, and that at the end of that story, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read it, I did feel like it was appropriate for the person who was suffering to be allowed to die. And I think that is really, it's really difficult to get to that place with a fictional character, let alone someone who, you actually know and have a real relationship with. But yeah, and same thing, I was reading spend a lot of time on Reddit. And I was reading something the other day. I think the question was like, if you are married to or in a long-term relationship with a partner who is mentally ill, like, do you regret it? Or like, if you could, go back and not start this relationship, would you? And
I'm so sorry.
a lot of people said that they wouldn't do it again because especially with something things that aren't necessarily physical illnesses can still take a toll on you and people talking about how being around someone who has severe or treatment resistant depression or who isn't interested or able to be interested in pursuing treatment that I don't want to say it can be contagious, but it just does affect other people. And yeah, I think it's usually anger at the situation, but also sometimes can be anger at the person. Because it's like, why aren't you trying harder? Or like, why can't you like I feel like as soon as you tell someone like, oh, you just have to do this or you just have to do that, like that's how you know that like for them it's not something you can just do.
Right, which is
But
not helpful
it's
advice ever.
yeah, but I still understand where that comes from. And I think we can all fall into that for in certain situations for someone else where it's like you can kind of so clearly see like what the next steps are or like what a possible path could be. But at the end of the day, I think the book deals with this as well. You can't get inside of someone else and make them do what you want. And so I think that that's where that kind of anger, which I guess is really frustration, comes from, and helplessness as well.
In the first few pages of the book, Khaki describes her friendship with Fiona as a cursed experiment in collaboration. What do you think it is about intimacy that makes possible toxicity, aka bringing out the worst in each other? I guess another way of asking this question, but it's also a separate question, is it really love if it's killing you both?
That's a good question. I think I don't know, this like sounds so silly, but it feels like very inappropriate for me to like definitively pass judgment on their relationship,
No, that's
because I'm
fair.
not a participant in it, but
I mean, you did
I
create
think
it.
I did. But yeah, I think especially in their situation, there's possibility for removing that toxicity and things like that. But I think especially when there aren't like other relationships in a person's life, I think that can often make it easier for that one relationship to have a greater possibility to have these negative aspects to it, because it's just really easy to get wrapped up in someone else and kind of expect them to be able to like be your everything and do everything that you want all the time. So that's like obviously not realistic. Again, you can't make other people do what you want. And so I think intimacy, especially if it's like the only intimacy or the primary form of intimacy in someone's life, if it is between people whose negative qualities or things that they're struggling with kind of complement each other, then that's like probably not a good situation. But then there are also examples where people who struggle with similar demons or addictions or whatever it is or illnesses are like the perfect people to help each other recover. So I think that it really depends. But like for the sake of this book, I needed some drama and some plot points, and so it was kind of like whenever given the chance, I made them more and more toxic. But I do think that with the distance that they've had, from each other, there could be some hope for a change of pace, but I don't know, who am I to say?
It's very kind of you to say that. I think you're giving a lot of, I think a lot of writers end up feeling a lot of love for their characters that they created. And so I feel like that's what I'm sensing from you too. You love these two girls. Who are you to judge them? Who are you to judge people that you love? But there are certain things that still seem quite pointed and like make up the shape of the novel very intentionally. So another question for you, what do you think Khaki gets so wrong about love for another person? She has it. She loves all these different people in her life, but at least from my perspective as a reader, she gets this idea of love so wrong, either too possessive or not involved enough, all of these sorts of things. And so I guess for you as again the creator of this character, do you think is there something that Khaki fundamentally doesn't understand about what it is to love someone?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the sort of root of that, or the background of that, is that when I started the book and was kind of putting together her character, I was very interested in this question of like, what are the kind of like material consequences of art? And so I was thinking, like, if you are a young person, but in particular, a girl who is getting a lot of your messages about love and relationships from, from okay to questionable to like, very problematic, love songs or songs about relationships, about failed relationships, many of which are from a male perspective. Like, is that going to like change your mindset and how you approach relationships, especially if you are interested in relationships with men? And I think the answer to that is like absolutely it will affect you. And so one of my proudest moments when I was working on drafts of the book was that someone read a male reader read the chapter where Khaki and Fiona first meet each other, and so it didn't have context of the rest of the book. And for the first couple of pages, he thought that Khaki was a boy. And I was like, yes, like I did it. Like, not because I'm like, oh, like, writing from a male perspective is like the best thing you can do, but like for her in particular, there is just like so much of her worldview that is informed by these things that I think she's like subconsciously absorbing from certain songs. And so I think that's part of her problem. I think her kind of blessing and curse is that she is, I think, very self-aware in some ways, and then like not self-aware at all in other ways. And so that made it fun to kind of, write in a way that's very close to her perspective, but then every once in a while have like another character say something that is there for for her, but also for the reader to like maybe question her a little bit. And so I think, again, like you can be really, really self-reflective, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're gonna like make good decisions all the time. So yeah, I think she's in some ways like expending a lot of energy on like trying to understand this concept, but not realizing that there's more to it.
A few pages later, Khaki identifies Fiona's self-awareness about her privilege, and Khaki says her describes it as such as Fiona's praxis is perfect. Her praxis is perfect. Is having a perfect praxis enough to absolve oneself of the responsibility of privilege?
Oh, well, I feel like
I
someone
know.
much smarter than me should be answering that
I mean,
question.
you wrote it. No, I think you're perfectly intellectually capable of, that's such a smart sentence to
Thank
identify that
you.
about Fiona as her praxis being perfect.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think that something I think about a lot in terms of kind of like these, critical theories and different, viewpoints and political frameworks and everything like that, and social frameworks, is that there's the theoretical, and then there's the practical, and the material. And I think that it's very easy to have, and important, to have conversations about like what things look like in an ideal world, or like what, the best possible situations are, like the best possible actions to take in a given scenario are. But I think that, I don't know, I guess as a writer, what's more interesting is the fact that like people aren't perfect, and so they're going to either contradict themselves or make mistakes, or they're going to change over time. I think that's a big question of the book as well, is like, do people change, and in what ways? And I think that if someone's doing their best, and like, maybe seems perfect, but then slips up, but is able to like kind of admit that and try to, act out some sort of like restorative justice or something and move on. Like, yeah, I think that's perfectly fine. I think the question of like, is that enough? I don't know. I don't think anything's ever enough, because like we're people, and like we can't all be like, yeah, just be perfect all the time. And so I think like if someone's like trying, like I don't know what else, to trying, and also like, being willing to be able to be held accountable, I don't really know what else we can ask of them.
On page 16, you write, "Pretty happened. I realize when someone grabbed part of you and obscured it with an invisible piece of herself. I didn't like to be grabbed, but the obscuration was pleasant." Can you elaborate for listeners what's being said here?
So I've always been very interested and conscious of not only beauty standards, but like cross-cultural beauty standards. When I saw someone else on the internet recently bring up these exact two things, and I felt very validated. But when I was younger, Jennifer Aniston was like touted as like one of the most beautiful women in the world, I was just confused. Like I don't think, I felt like I had a good handle on like, okay, these are like our white American beauty standards. But then when I was told that like she was at like the kind of top of the food chain, I was like, oh, maybe I don't understand what our beauty standards are. Or when I was growing up, and like the media would like not stop talking about J-Lo's butt, and I was like, her butt is normal sized, like I don't understand like why we're talking about this. But obviously it's like, okay, what is the context, like which parts of the media are saying these things, and kind of, what is considered attractive by whom, and how do those things change over time. And I think, it's not just like nationality or race or ethnicity that plays into it. There's class, and like, where you are within a country as well. And so I'm so interested, like this sounds like so weird, like I'm so interested in like other how people judge each other's looks.
Oh, I am too. That
just
does sound
I
weird.
just yeah I just think it's like interesting. Like I don't think it's like meaningful in terms of like, how you should, treat someone or whatever. But I was just like to know like what people consider beautiful or not beautiful, and why. But anyway, in that passage, I'm just trying to point to the kind of subjectivity and often like arbitrary nature of these things in terms of the assignment of beauty as something that is not reflects like not self-reflexive, not something that you're doing to yourself, but something that other people are doing to you. And I think that it can be both, but you can't stop people from, doing what they're going to do in terms of assigning or not assigning you beauty. And I think that's just something to keep in mind when evaluating yourself and others. I This is gonna sound like really weird, and I don't even know if I like truly believe this, but like I do think, or I do wonder sometimes if like it's almost a form of violence to assign beauty to someone, because if something about their appearance changes, like what does that what does that mean then, for your estimation of them or your evaluation of them? But then obviously like it's such a like positive thing in many ways to assign beauty to someone. And while I'm talking about physical beauty, and like yes, I know that your relationship with someone can and your familiarity with them can determine how you evaluate their looks, but I think that and this is obviously like very complicated depending on how you do or don't fit into mainstream beauty standards, but I don't know, like for me, I think that I fit some of those, but others I definitely don't, and I don't think I would want to fit more of them. Like I think it would be like absolutely awful to be like Sydney Sweeney or someone where it's just like so like I don't know, like
Why do you think
that
that would be awful?
because it's just like there's so much attention, and like yeah, most of it is positive, but like on her looks and her body, and she does happen to fit a lot of the like kind of most desirable traits, and I think that just exposes you to more and more scrutiny. And I think that there's a big tension in the book that kind of speaks to this in terms of like, is it, I think in some ways like being having attention paid to you as if it can be a very positive and necessary thing, but I also think that you should be allowed to opt out of it when you want to. And I think that especially as a woman, that the more conventionally attractive you are, the harder it can be to have like peace. But I also know that there are like very again, material social consequences for women who don't fit into to those standards that in many ways will objectively make your life worse. So I don't want to say like, oh, I feel so bad for hot people, and like it
It's nuanced.
it's yeah.
No, for sure it's nuanced. What do you think Fiona offers Khaki that starts this platonic love affair at all? And I guess similarly, what do you think Khaki offered Fiona?
Yeah, I think the way she phrases it is something along the lines of like Fiona seems to feel have this freedom or feel this empowerment to like not be okay. Again, hopefully not in a way that feels like it's romanticizing that, but just like having that space that I think is like more often accessible, to someone who is white or wealthier or whatever. And so I think that is attractive. I think it's also kind of like, I don't know, I think their relationship does feel like a no judgment zone. I think they both like are doing and saying like ridiculous things and like not really having to be called out on that. And I think that again, I mean, like I was saying earlier about like the pro Anna corners of the internet, like yes, a net negative overall, but I do think just feeling like you can be honest with someone about good and bad things that you're feeling is really attractive, especially to young people, and kind of knowing that like, oh, she's not going to think I'm too like weird or too gross or like whatever. So I think they have that going, both of them for the other, and I think that I for both of them too, actually, I think it's like the appeal of like a fresh start, and that Kaki kind of like hears some stuff from other people about who Fiona is, but like she hasn't, grown up with her, and so it's kind of like, her just kind of like going in somewhat blind to the relationship. And I think that goes both ways too, in terms of just like there's not that like baggage necessarily to start with. They can just kind of shape their own narratives that they're going to bring to this relationship, and then like end up shaping each other along the way. I think they're kind of both implicitly kind of, or in an unspoken way, entering into it in that way of like, okay, we both kind of see that other people aren't interested in hanging out with us. I don't really know who you are. You don't really know who I am. Let's just like take this opportunity to be who we want to be and see where it goes.
On page 70, Khaki mediates on her ambivalence towards the Arctic Monkeys. She shares a personal theory that if you listen to a band enough times, you'd learn to love it. She compares this relationship to the idea of an arranged marriage, for example. I guess it made me wonder, do you think the same understanding could be applied to novels, to readers of novels? Because I know
Ooh.
this to be true of like musical theory, right? Listening to a song enough times and suddenly you love it. But can you read a novel enough times and suddenly love it?
That is a really good question. I've never thought about that. I don't think so. I think there's something like more, I mean, obviously, like one of the main differences is between reading and other ways of being an audience of something is that it is like very active. You can't, you have to look at the page and read it. You can't just like, sit and hear something or have something in front of you that's like a picture that you just kind of look at. And so I think that because there is like whatever that extra layer is that you're having to do, I think you can maybe get to know a book better. And I think maybe you can learn, if you're also reading some reviews or theory or whatever alongside it, maybe get to like understand it better or have a better understanding of like why other people like it. But I like two books that I tried and tried and I just cannot with are Heart of Darkness and Frankenstein. And Heart of Darkness, like, I know they're like, it's satire. It's satire. He wasn't racist. I'm not, I don't know.
No,
I'm
there's a
not saying
huge
that.
but. There's a huge but coming.
I'm not saying that I know better than, like, Joseph Conrad scholars or anything. But I think for me, and I have read it more than once, but this was, I think, both times were when I was in high school, maybe early college. I just didn't, and maybe this is just the kind of disconnect across history and culture and everything, but like to me, the value or apparentness of the satire was not enough to justify. I also just think the book is so boring. Like it's just like the most boring book I've, it's only like 100 pages and it just like feels like it's like 700. So like I don't know, I maybe I'll try again and see if I can get into that book. And then like with Frankenstein, I think it's like obviously an amazing concept, but I don't know, there's just something like kind of goofy about it to me, like the particular plot points and like a lot of the, to me, a lot of the male characters didn't feel very dimensional. But
Did you
I
like
like,
Poor Things? Did you see Poor Things?
I,
The subversive Frankenstein story.
is it subversive or like should she have had her period? I don't know. That's how I feel about that movie. It was
Obsessed with that
it was very, I think it was like, well acted and like, I think parts of the humor landed. I think visually it was beautiful. I think the music was great. But I just, I'm reading the book right now, which I hear is better. But
It's a
I'm
different
not very
experience,
far.
honestly. Yeah. I don't know if you're feeling that way, but I did.
Yeah. I think that the humor could have been so much better. Like there were just so many opportunities for there to be like funny ways that she is menstruating or has more body hair. Like, where did her body hair go? I'm unclear on that. Like, you could do like I just felt like the sex scenes, it was just like the same thing over and over again, and like the joke, like could not handle that much sort of repetition. And I think that like if we wanted to have a humorous examination of like, oh, what is this person, what is sex like for her when she first discovers it and starts having it? It's like, okay, sure, that could be like one joke in the movie instead of kind of like
The
the only joke
entire
in that
movie,
movie. And there could have been like so many like funny ways to see her react to other things that would have happened with her body. Like, what if I feel like she could have had a funny reaction to like finding out that like sex can lead to children and like what giving birth is like could have been like really funny, but felt a little one note to me in terms of how her body was treated when there was so much like opportunity, I think, to do more with it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot of like
No,
now
that's
film
okay.
critic. You're a film critic, but you're just it's I mean, if we're gonna talk about Frankenstein, it does seem like a relevant current sort of relation. I don't wanna correlate too much with you and the character of Khaki, even though like basically it's what I do to every author ever. This is the my wrath. But given the breadth of musical knowledge that the book involves, you either A did plenty of research, or just in talking to you, this line on page 20 would be deeply relatable, and I feel like it is. You'll let me know. Music is the only thing that wanted me instead of her. And I guess I, as a big music fan, the her obviously could mean multiple things to lots of people in this outside of context use, but I've always thought that music wanted me. And I guess I wanted to ask you that question. In what ways has music wanted you? I'd love for you to describe that feeling if you could.
I think that that's a really interesting question. I think that maybe the reason I was an attractive candidate is because I tend to like go just really deep on things that I'm interested in. And something that I have to learn over and over again is that like not everyone is like that. And so for me, it's just like I don't understand. Like it's just hard for me to wrap my head around someone who, and it's totally valid and fine. And I do not think I'm like better than anyone or anything like that. I think like music snobbery is very ridiculous. But like someone who, for in instance, like maybe was really into like Taking Back Sunday and like even Brand New or Fall Out Boy and like those bands, like that to me like made me just want to like know so much more about like the context and like where that fit into music history and like do all of these deep dives. But I know some people they don't like they don't they're just not interested in that. Like they're just gonna listen to kind of what comes to them. And I think that the possibilities and the opportunities that music gave me to like do research basically it's just like very appealing. So I mean not as much anymore just because I don't functionally have the time to do it. But I'm definitely one to really commit and go down a rabbit hole and everything like that, and to tell other people about it if they're interested. Though I like very much don't believe in like trying to push, especially this kind of music on other people, because a lot of it I'm like, oh no, I understand why you would have no desire to listen to this. But yeah, I think that was part of it. But I also just think that I'm again just like very interested in how other people experience the world, whether it's like who they think is hot or like what they're singing about, and or both, maybe them singing about who they think is hot or not. And so I think that I mean, there's obviously song lyrics are very important to me. I'm a very word-oriented person, but there's also music I listen to where I have no idea what they're saying. I can't understand them. But I think that's another way that I got kind of hooked in, was just being able to kind of see how people, either, verbally or instrumentally, wanted to express themselves. And I think I'm very drawn to this thing that I can't really describe, where it just sounds like you can just like really hear that someone is struggling, and that it's often not kind of technically well executed or whatever, but like I will always prefer that to someone who can just like belt things out perfectly. I like to hear kind of someone straining their voice or getting a little shaky or something. So I don't know if that answers the question.
It does. It does. It definitely does. This next question is definitely going to direct yourself to khaki again. It's actually a question to you. And again,
Okay.
feel free to correct me if it's unfair, but it was something that I could relate to. I don't know how far we are age-wise. I feel like we're approximate. I'm 34.
I'm 30, yeah.
There you go. So I personally can relate to this idea of being like a lone woman of color in a sea of white people at shows I would go to in my younger days. And I mean, I'm going to speak on your behalf, but we probably don't go to as many shows as we used to. But I'm sort of wondering if this experience has changed for you at all. And how it would make you feel today.
Yeah, I think for me, it's never like particularly, I think it's something I'm aware of, but it doesn't necessarily make me uncomfortable. And I think part of that is because for me, that was never like my primary social scene. Like I had, sometimes there are friends there with me, but that wasn't, I don't know, that just wasn't where my like interpersonal relationships really lied. And so I think it wasn't like super high stakes for me in that way, in terms of needing to feel like that person to person connection. I think it's, I don't know, I don't think it's something I probably, honestly, like more like now, so I would feel like, oh, I'm old, and like that would be like the thing that like felt like it would stick out about me, even though I'm, probably comparatively not going to be the oldest person in one of these rooms. But I think it's something that is kind of like just a fact, but not something that, I don't know, that I personally like have a lot to say about or have a lot of feelings about. I think like sometimes that's whether it's work-wise or whatever, the situation that you're in, and sometimes it's not. And something that I think is interesting about punk in particular is, I think there is this like interesting insistence on like, oh, there's always been, a presence of, people of various colors, or of women, or queer people, or whatever. But I also, every once in a while, I worry that that is getting like pushed to a point where it is becoming like overblown and kind of overestimating the overall, like, just, I don't know where we'd get the statistics on this, but like the actual like numbers, in terms of like, yes, there have always been some, but it's like that's never been the dominant kind of, that's never been the norm. And I don't like when people kind of conflate a presence with being like the dominant presence, because then I think it can set people up for having like false expectations for like, oh, I'm going to go into this space and like it's going to be so kind of keyed into, or just like filled with people with my background or something like that, and then it's not. And like, yeah, for some people that would be really difficult, and for some people it just kind of comes with the territory. I think I don't know, I think for me, my gender always felt more, I don't know what the word is, palpable in those spaces. And I think I don't know, maybe it's also Like there were, some spaces where I was like definitely like one of the younger people there. I'm like not a very large person. And so I think just like kind of feeling like, a little girl, was
Absolutely.
like very something I can still feel depending on what shoes I'm wearing. So there's that angle to it as well. But I don't want to, dismiss other people's experiences if that like is something that they really have to grapple with, either in years past or to this day. But I think I just kind of knew what I was getting going in, and I was like, okay, I think it is what it is, and what am I gonna do about it?
My last question for you is kind of
Yeah.
pushing this point, but I hear you, and honestly, I feel the same way. I pretty much agree and relate to everything that you just said. But another thread from that very conversation that's especially palpable for Khaki in this novel, I guess I kept thinking about if you could talk a bit about what you think is taken from the Black woman when robbed of anger. And the reason I'm asking that question is because you write about in this book the way that Khaki's mother robs her of this. As you write, it forces her, because she's robbed of this, it forces her to take up sadness instead. Excuse me. But then it forces her to take up sadness instead. And yes, that's what the emo music was for, but she certainly has an inclination towards angry music too. And I sort of, it made me think of what could anger have served her that maybe her mother didn't realize, very understandably trying to protect her from this, very unfortunate stereotype with all these negative connotations. But in what ways could anger have served her instead of been the detriment to her existence?
Yeah, I think I'm just remembering that like as I wrote more and more drafts of the book and got it into better and better shape, I did try to like highlight her sort of like violent side more and more, and like these kind of violent thoughts that she has towards Ben sometimes, towards Fiona. And really like lean into that anchor, and I think even I like struggled to kind of put it on the page enough at first, even though I did want it to be there. And I think everyone is probably owed the full range of human emotions, and there's obviously, there need to be limitations to that. You shouldn't just like tell someone be as angry as you want all the time with no kind of awareness of like where that's coming from or what that might be kind of a secondary emotion of or things like that. But I think that getting angry and then from there being able to do more with that. So in terms of like being able to reflect on, maybe you need to work on like coping skills, and that's what your anger is telling you, or maybe your anger is telling you that like you're being mistreated and it's okay for you to do something about that. Like, I think it can serve so many different functions. I think some of it can really just be like a sort of physical release of tension or a way to like deal with or build up adrenaline or something like that. This isn't exactly like anger related, but like people are like often surprised like to hear that I'm like very into like lifting weights and stuff like that. Like I'm kind of a jock at heart in many ways, and I think that that's like a really great way that can be a really great way to process anger, and it can then have like positive health benefits as well. So I think there's like so many different things that it can lead to, but it is something that should be kind of analyzed and dug into, and not just kind of like accepted as like, oh yeah, you should walk around being angry all the time, because that's probably not good for you or for the people around you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Listeners, you can pick up a copy of I Love You So Much, It's Killing Us Both in Montreal at Librairie Pulp Books and Cafe or wherever you fulfill your indie bookselling needs. Thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Thank you.